Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, June 10th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk science with Barb Ravitz, Dr. Jim Pickett, and Dr. Ed Stander. They're ready to answer your questions about chemistry, geology, biology, whatever else you might throw at them. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email your questions and comments to voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Your calls are coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. In the studio, we have three scientists. Barbara Bravitz is a professor of biology and chemistry at SUNY Cobleskill for over 20 years. Dr. Ed Stander is a professor of geology, astronomy, and environmental sciences at SUNY Cobleskill. And Dr. Jim Pickett, a retired organic chemist of 33 years who worked at GE Global Research, specializes in the stability of plastics. If you have a science question of any stripe, give us a call, 800-348-2551. It's a photo op here, and it's annoying me. 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. It shouldn't be surprising that once Ed is back in the studio, the annoyance meter starts picking up a little bit, and he's taking pictures.
Yeah.
Ed Stander, welcome back to the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to be back. I've missed you so much, Ray.
It's great to have you back.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And well, you know, it's better than the alternative, right?
Sure enough. Yeah. And I'm not in pajamas. It feels good.
So you did the show.
Don't ask the question.
Dr. Jim Pickett, how are you, buddy?
I am just fine.
We had our geek factor at level 7 when you showed us your COVID mask with all the chemical compounds on there.
That's right.
The elements.
My wife found the fabric at one of the local
fabric stores. Oh, she made that herself?
Yep.
I apologize.
Oh, that's all right. It is. And she made one for my son, the chemical engineer, too, that he... proudly wore.
I think it's very nice. It looks good on you, though, as they say. And you know, Barbara Bravitz, you are looking younger as opposed to these other two. They look like they aged about 28 years. You look younger than ever. What happened?
I'm just tickled to be here, Ray.
Are you really?
Tickled.
Well, it's great to have you both here, all of you here, some more than others. Looking at you, Ed. We had a great chat about beer going into the program here in Studio A.
Maybe that's why I look so good. I was thinking about beer.
Well, go get one. We got some in the front.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you know what? You're not running the show. Go ahead, have a beer. Jim Pickett, you told me something very interesting about the number of bubbles in a bottle of beer. How'd you find this out?
I found this out on the YouTube channel that the American Chemical Society runs, whose name escapes me at the moment. It used to be called Reactions. It may still be called Reactions. Anyway, on that, they said that the number of bubbles in a bottle of beer or a can of beer would be somewhere between 200,000 and a million.
Now, what would explain the variation?
Probably
size.
It has to do with level of carbonation, how much carbon dioxide and other gases are in there. And then the size of the bubble, which will depend a lot on the size of the little imperfections or dirt or little nicks in the glass.
Interesting.
So the dirtier it is, the more bubbles there'd be.
But they might be bigger.
That's interesting. Now, does it matter what chemical is used? In other words,
Guinness has nitrogen.
Or Boddington's,
it's nitrogen.
Nitrogen.
Yeah.
And those bubbles are very velvety. I don't even like them. They're too, they're not bubbly enough
for me. They're too normal. And they don't have any flavor to them, really, because they don't influence pH in your mouth, but carbon dioxide does, and
really?
That's why there's some flavor to carbonation.
I did not know.
Yeah.
But the nitrogen bubbles are more velvety and more tiny. Is that it?
I don't know whether that's that or because the beers in which nitrogen might be in contain more proteins that might act as surfactants and give a foamier foam.
It's also a thicker beer, and as a result, the bubbles can't get much bigger because they start to compress in because of surface tension.
All right, now, scientists, I'm giving you your first homework assignment. I would like you to buy...
I'm writing this one down.
Buy at least 8 different kinds of beer from different countries and drink them all and study subjectively the bubbles.
Well, here's another one. Here's
at
another
different levels
thing.
Of inebriation,
exactly.
Of course.
Exactly.
Yeah. Here's another thing about beer, which is really useful, is that when you take a bottle of beer and you pop it, you open it up suddenly, what you're doing is you're, because of the pressure of the carbon dioxide in it, the carbon dioxide expands very quickly, which cools it off very fast. And as a result, you get a cloud coming out of your beer. So you're actually producing clouds when you pop a can of beer or a bottle of beer.
Let's talk non-alcoholic beverages just for a moment, and I apologize to the panel for doing this. But I had a very bold ginger beer. Well, it was actually a ginger ale, but it was bold and it had a lot of ginger. Always makes me sneeze. Why?
Ooh, maybe you're allergic to ginger.
No, I love ginger.
Well, maybe you're allergic to it. I love things that I'm allergic to, like ice cream.
No, you're allergic to ice cream?
I'm allergic to milk.
My condolences to you.
Yeah, it's really...
I'm sorry.
I suffer.
I know that ginger beer, when it forms the foam, forms a lighter foam. And it's the chances are that when you start drinking it, that foam's going to wind up your nose faster. And so that could be very easily the reason.
Very interesting. Well, this has been a really...
This is almost Food Friday. You know that, Ray, right?
Yeah.
It's the closest we've ever gotten to a Food Friday on a Thursday.
I miss it.
The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, doesn't have to be about beer. 800-348-2551. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Bravitz make up the panel today, and they're here in the studio for the first time in well over a year. We had an email from DR in Troy. And DR writes, if stars are all fusing helium to hydrogen, and the explosions of old stars and death of their remaining cores is not unfusing hydrogen, then ultimately there's no more helium, and does the universe just go dark in the end?
Wow. Well, first of all, they're fusing hydrogen to helium, not the other way around. And the typical star is about two-thirds hydrogen to one-third helium. The helium, depending on what happens to the star, if the star blows up, if it compacts because it runs out of helium and hydrogen, then the pressure in there is going to effectively develop all the other elements that there are around.
Up to iron.
Up to iron. No. It'll go past iron because it's compressing. By fusion, you can't go past iron.
Okay.
But if you take a large star and you compress it because it runs out of energy in the center, so effectively it's like an old television set that implodes. When it implodes, the pressures can be so great that it can produce everything else, effectively uranium and everything else.
And that's where it all comes from.
And that's where it comes from.
Very interesting. This one is from Ernie. Another astronomy-related question. Ernie in Scotia wrote this quite a while back today. With small orbiting objects in distant space pointing to the possibility of a planet X, if it exists, how is it possible that we can't find it? And that's from Ernie in Scotia.
The best evidence we have for a planet X at this moment is that long-term comets, which come from outside of our solar system or in what's called the Oort cloud, tend to all come from the same area of the sky, which suggests that there might be something out there which is perturbating the things and making them come into the center.
Yep.
And as such, anything that's very, very large but doesn't give off light, we would not be able to see it. A good example would be a brown dwarf or something which is just not giving off enough energy otherwise, but it's relatively large. So Planet X may exist, but it's very, very hard to see because there's nothing giving energy to it that we can then reflect back to us.
No,
but we could. But obviously, if a planet X exists in our solar system, then it has to have some mass in order to do this perturbation. Is that the idea?
Sure.
But it doesn't take much to perturb a comet. I mean, otherwise, we could probably do the calculations and figure out where Planet X should be?
It takes very little to perturb a comet because it's relatively small. And as the star or whatever it is comes closer to the comet, the gravitational force causes it to ricochet off.
Well, it takes very little to perturb me, except when we go past the break, and it's break time. It's Science Forum Day. We have Jim Pickett. We have Ed Stander. We have Barbara Bravitz. We have you. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Lawrence Welk Show. It's 2:20. It's a Science Forum Day on a Thursday. Ray Graff with you on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And before we get to the phones and a couple of more items in the email bag, way back when, Barbara Brabets, you had homework.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was a discussion about microbes back in December of 2020.
Yikes.
I know.
I don't even remember back that far.
Well, you know, it was when we thought there was a vaccine coming, but we weren't sure.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
So we were all on a phone, and Bernard Smith wrote me.
Yeah.
And he says, I frequently hear you on Science Forum, and I realize that you may be far too busy to respond to this question, but I'm back in the studio, Bernard. Of course, it's 6 months later. I regularly make cheese, and I regularly make wine, and while I can use lab-cultured yeasts to ferment sugars, if I take leftover whey from my cheese making, I can't seem to get it to ferment.
Okay.
And so I did a little bit of research. Oh, and he did qualify to say that he can make it happen if he adds lactase tablets
All right.
to his material. Now, lactase is an enzyme that allows lactose to be fermented.
Okay.
But the problem is that yeast really can't do lactose alone unless they break down the lactose into its component sugars, because lactose is not just a basic sugar.
All right.
And usually it requires bacteria to do that. So that you get something called a mixed culture, a little bit of bacteria to do your dirty work for you, and then the yeast gets all of the glory to do the fermentation part that everyone wants to drink or eat. And so I did some work, and I contacted a fellow Kobolskillian, Larry Bopp, and asked, who's been a microbiologist since the dawn of time. I hope you're listening, Larry, and asked him if there were any yeast that could do it directly without bacterial help. And he went back into the literature to 1948 and found some evidence back then that they had found a yeast that could do so. But it turned out that after that, they had a contaminated sample that had bacteria in it. So even the literature was wrong, because it was a mixed culture anyway. So you need a little either help from an enzyme or help from a bacteria to do the initial breakdown, and then your yeast can go to town and make your cheese or your kefir or your wine or beer. So we might have either kind of planetary and beer theme today. We always end up with themes in these shows.
But at least the show is yeasty, and that's the main thing.
Planetary beer. That's not bad.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Science Forum Day, 800-348-2551. At Standard, Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets here, and some email. Tell you what, before we go to our stack of emails here, let's grab Joan. That didn't come out right. Joan, you're on. Hello.
Hello. Hello, Ray. Hello, all of our science experts. And you're making me so thirsty for either a Guinness or whatever planetary beer turns out to be.
I was thinking a beer planet would be better than planetary beer.
Oh, I like that better.
Oh. Yeah. As long as it's chilled.
Well, what do you got for us today, Joan?
sorry, I'm still thinking beer. Okay, guys. I wanted to, I can't seem to wrap my mind around understanding mechanical sources of energy and how it gets stored and used. I should describe, my lifestyle is what I would call neo-techno-Duddite. I do like my electric lights and refrigeration and stuff. In my youth, we had this flashlight that I think it was a magnet that went through a copper spool. And if you could, you know, wave it back and forth fast enough, long enough, you could actually create a little bit of light with it. And now I listen to the radio on the cool WAMC radio, where you can do the crank charge.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're there long enough, you can, you know, get, I think it was 15 minutes of radio time. I don't think I understand how chemical reactions like lithium batteries and stuff work, and how mechanical processes work for energy storage.
This is a long, it'll be a long show, Joan, but we're going to hand it over to Jim Pickett.
Okay. First, the mechanical. Basically, what you need to do is run a magnet past a coil of wire, and you'll make electricity. Electrons will move around in the copper wire. and all generators work that way. Okay. Whether it's the shuka shake light or the crank radio or a electric power plant.
Right.
They all work.
They all do the shuka.
They do the shuka.
All right.
The the chemical batteries is a little more difficult to explain on the radio.
Well, it's the movement of electrons again. You create an electron gradient, and you give an electron a path, or a bunch of electrons a path to flow in. And there's only one direction that you're going to run it spontaneously. You can recharge those batteries by reversing the direction that the electrons move from one material to another. So like a lithium ion battery, or like a typical copper zinc battery, which is like your the ones we always use in lab, you can get about, is it 1.2 volts? I think it's 1.25 volts out of one little battery. Now, how big that battery is will give you how long it will run before it needs to be recharged. So whether it's a AAA, a AA, a C, or a D, really has to do with how many amp hours you have stored, or milliamp hours.
Yeah, and the way that basically a lot of these work is that a metal in its neutral state will give up its an electron to one of the electrodes. That electron goes around through the circuit and back into the other side of the battery, where there is something else which can take up the electron.
Usually it's metal ions in solution that then get reduced by grabbing that electron and plating on the other electrode.
Yep. So in doing that, it is energetically downhill. So you can push those electrons through the wire with some kind of voltage and do useful work or make light.
Radio Shack, I miss Radio Shack.
Yeah, me too.
I wish it were back. Used to sell a potato clock.
Yeah.
And I still have two of them. One radio, like realistic brand potato clock. And then I bought another one after Radio Shack died. And then I show this in my lab. And I'm like, it doesn't have to be potatoes, folks. It can be anything that has a little bit of copper and a little bit of zinc in it. So my students always take this as a challenge. And I've had like day old beer.
Okay.
Now we go again because there's copper.
Right.
Day old beer. I've had oranges, coffee, whatever they can find in the recycling bin. And as long as you have the two solutions, I mean, it's easy enough to see whether or not it works, because the clock will either blink 12 or it won't blink 12.
Yeah.
If you've got enough voltage to run the potato clock. I've run a potato clock off of two oranges for about 3.5 weeks, and it's mainly the smell of the decaying oranges that makes you throw it out. So, you know, if you ever lose your AA batteries, I wouldn't recommend shoving that in the back of your cell phone. But
interesting.
It works.
Well, great call, Joan. Hey, thank you for really getting us going here.
Amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much for checking in. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Science Forum today. Barbara Bravitz is on fire today. Ed Stander and Jim Pickett also stepping up to the plate. Now, this one is from Phil. Phil says, could a hydrothermal process replace all of the mafic minerals in a metamorphic rock with magnetite? And in doing so, wipe out any metamorphic fabric in the emitter rock. I don't know what I just read. Should I read it again, or did you understand, Ed?
Would you like to give it to me so I can read it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Look at what we could do in the studio.
Wow.
Pass a piece of paper.
You know, do me a favor. Read it out loud.
Could a hydrothermal process replace all the mafic minerals in the metamorphic rock with magnetite, and in doing so, wipe out any metamorphic fabric in the emitter rock?
That's what I said.
Okay, yeah, that's exactly what you said. Yeah, a hydrothermal process is where hot liquids, usually water or something like that, run through a rock, and as a result, they are able to add elements to that rock and as a result change the material. Generally speaking, what you wind up getting is a rock which has the same fabric, doesn't change very much, but winds up being made of something else.
Is that like a petrified tree?
Well, sort of. A very good example is years ago I went up to Asbestos, Quebec. And asbestos, of course, this is fibrous material. And the fibrous material is made of asbestos. If you have liquid coming through it, which contains iron, for example, the iron can replace the asbestos and you wind up getting fibrous magnetite.
Ah,
so the fabric doesn't change, but the structure of it changes as you add or subtract elements to the material. There you go.
Okay.
So I think your answer is almost.
So metamorphic fabrics don't get destroyed, but the structure of the material can change.
Fair enough. This one's from Bob. And Jim, I think you'll be very excited by this question. Here we go.
I'm ready.
Really?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Just cool your jets, Jim. This is going to be exciting. I've read that some museums are having problems with some of their exhibits made of plastics that are deteriorating, decomposing. What can be done to arrest the deterioration and preserve the objects?
Ooh, that is a really good question.
See?
And unfortunately, I don't know the full answer.
Oh.
But a lot of these are the old like nitrocellulose stuff. And that's prone to degradation, and unfortunately, as it degrades, it generates acid, which then causes the degradation to go faster. And the way I think, if an object isn't too far gone, they can probably put something basic in there to take up the acid and buffer it, to so that it slows down that process. But the thing is that plastic is just not forever. That it's going to degrade if it's out where there's some temperature, and there's, especially if sunlight gets to it.
Yeah,
it's dead meat.
I can give a good example of that was going to Japan, where outside of every restaurant there are these beautiful plastic examples of what the food is like, and generally speaking, they look terrible because the sunlight is degrading it to the point where it looks like sort of this waffly stuff with terrible colors, and it's just miserable.
Yeah. So some plastics also will fall apart very abruptly. There's one that's kind of a hard plastic called polypropylene that will be just seem fine one day, and then next week literally crumble in your hand.
Yeah.
Because it just falls off this cliff of degradation.
And will sunlight, like with polypropylene, I think they make ropes and things out of this. And will the sunlight really whack that?
Yes.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, for plastics like that, there are stabilizers that work really, really well so that things like polypropylene ropes can be stabilized so they'll last.
Yeah, the UV stabilization.
Yeah, for many years, even perhaps decades.
But polypropylene is a pretty cheap commodity to begin with. So if you're going to make something super cheap, you're not going to buy the upgraded polypropylene, right? But maybe if you're like a nautical rope manufacturer, people are going to pay quality, you know, money for that. Mm. But if it's a piece of lawn furniture that you buy at Dollar General, it may not have the same stability.
It's the Science Forum today. The number is 800-348-2551. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, Barbara Brabitz join us today. And before we get to the next call, Jim, you mentioned nitrocellulose. And I know, like, if you had a 1954 Strat, old guitar or something, it's got a nitrocellulose finish. They still make higher-end Gibsons and nicer guitars that have this finish. And one of the things that collectors, and I am not a collector, but they'll say, oh yeah, the checking of this finish is wonderful. What's going on there with the nitrocellulose? In other words, it changes over time, and the collectors will say, oh, it's nicer now 30 years later. What's going on with that?
By that, you mean, is it changing color? Is it the patina?
It's like cracking.
Oh, cracking. Well, then it's just degrading.
Well, and I think I can go back to beer here, in that cellulose and nitrocellulose are both degraded by fungi. Because if you think about it, nitrocellulose is just a modified cellulose, cellulose being wood. And what degrades wood? Fungi, right? So if you have you could just be in your normal house and you have spores that land. And I just pulled up a paper thinking that maybe I had something here on I'm cheating on my cell phone.
You know what?
And
it's not right.
I know it's not right. We've been not doing this for years.
Set a good example, Barbara.
But it said that fungi were the biggest degraders of nitrocellulose.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but in the case of guitars, what actually happens more likely is that as nitrocellulose gets old, it becomes very, very brittle. And as a result, the guitar expanding and contracting will cause it to crack and form tension cracks.
Yeah. Our number here, once again, is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Rick in Hudson. Rick, you're on.
Well, good afternoon. Glad to have the entire panel back in the studio.
You're telling me.
In electricity, AC, DC, and you have a copper wire or a conductor, current passing through a DC current passing through a conductor does not, from what I understand, does not produce a phenomenon known as skin effect. Current AC current passing through a conductor produces a phenomenon called skin effect, S-K-I-N. What is skin effect? Why does AC produce it and DC does not?
I've never heard that term, but then I'm a chemist, not an electrical engineer.
If anybody wants this, that's fine. Otherwise, we will save this for the next time that Roger Giboni is on. He is our electrical guy, and he could explain that like that. But
yeah, I've never heard the term.
I have.
Rick.
I am a retired HVAC mechanic, and I was reading some old journals and saw this article about skin effect. And okay. I don't know what it is, and that's why I'm calling in
today. Okay, well, Ed, you go ahead. Well,
I can tell you that amongst the audiophiles, again, Roger would be better.
Could you speak up a little bit, please?
Okay.
Oh, well, effectively, Roger would be better with this because he's the audio guy. But there's a lot of discussion as to what happens to copper wire when you run a signal through it over a period of time. And if you're an audiophile, people spend fortunes on equipment that supposedly changes the structure of the wire by running electricity through it. And there's never been any proof whatsoever that it actually happens. And this is all part of this change that supposedly occurs at the outer edges of the wire, which allow it to conduct electricity better. And as far as I know, it's never been proven whether it actually exists to any great extent or not.
Rick, thanks for the call. I know that it's also a thing in radio engineering and in coaxial line and in feed lines. And so we will table that question, Rick, and we will next time Roger's on with us, we will bring that up again. Remember, panel, skin effect, and we'll bring it up, and that'll be his homework, even though he doesn't know he has homework. Let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, I got a question for you guys.
Right.
I was on my computer at home last night, and it said, is the Bermuda Triangle really a dangerous place? And where do the people go where they get disappeared? I always had that theory.
Well, I mean, I guess you'd have to be a statistician, and I guess you would have to probably look at various other areas of ocean about the same size and see what the deal is. Jim?
Yeah, well, the Bermuda Triangle's pretty big.
Yeah.
So accidents happen, and I don't think there's any evidence that there's more strange things happen.
Per event or per crossing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we have transatlantic flight lines. They're kind of like highways across the ocean. You don't just, you know, pick any place to cross. You know, there's places that airline traffic kind of stick to. And so one of these passageways in the air goes across the Bermuda Triangle. There are other parts of the Atlantic that aren't really passed by, not because they're more or less dangerous, but because it's not energetically efficient to use that path to get from point A to point B. So it could just be a matter of frequency.
Do you think there are aliens in the Bermuda Triangle?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Atlantis?
Well, no, I mean, I'm wearing a T-shirt that says science is real. I'd like to see evidence before I can make such a determination.
And you need good, strong evidence for something of a claim like
that.
It
wouldn't even just be one piece of evidence. Yeah, it would have to be multiple pieces of evidence, yes.
Well, Chris, thanks for leading us into our next break. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's the Science Forum. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets, and Ed Stander are here, and we'll hit the email bag again. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Hey, it's 41 minutes after the hour. Floyd Kramer here on WAMC. It's the Vox Pop Show, which is not really about the old 1967 instrumental favorites. It's a science forum today, and it's a call-in show. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Barbara Brabitz is here from SUNY Cobleskill. Ed Stander is here from Kobe as well. Jim Pickett is very relaxed. He's retired, but he was at GE for a long time, which is very stressful. This is from Jacob in Cahoes. Jacob says, I don't understand, and I'm embarrassed, but I don't understand how some water can be more oxygenated than other water bodies. I know that fast-moving water is more oxygenated, but how can there be more O2 in H2O? Apologies, because I probably asked this in a worse form on a previous show. And Jacob, before we get to the answer, there are no bad questions except the ones that I ask.
Barbara. Only bad answers.
Oh, so I think I was here when Jacob asked the question the first time, and I think I didn't understand that he thought there were extra O's in the formula of water. In reality, the oxygen we're talking about in well-oxygenated water is part of a mixture where water is your solvent, and then oxygen gas is dissolved in the water, in the same way that sugar can get dissolved in your coffee.
Or carbon dioxide in beer.
Or carbon dioxide in water that then can go make beer. So the oxygen can get captured within the water by contact with oxygen in the air, or if we put a bubbler through it, like in an aquarium. And then, of course, it's really three biggies there. It is temperature. It is how much salt is in the water, because the salts that make up salt can react with the oxygen and remove it from water. So the more salty, the harder it is to have oxygen in the water.
Yeah.
And then pH has something to do with it, but it's a much smaller phenomenon. So it's mostly temperature.
Okie dokie. This one, oh boy, this is a rant. And, I like a good rant as much as anybody. This is from Andrew. Andrew says, if we can have cars that essentially drive themselves on public highways, refrigerators on the web, the Internet of Everything madness, why am I and dozens of other cars stopped at red lights for 30 seconds with absolutely no intersection cross traffic? If we can have those boutique bourgeois technology applications, why can't we have widespread greater good technology applications like smart traffic lights? And that's from Andrew. Andrew, I admire your rant, sir. Who wants it?
Can we vote? Is it a binding vote if we vote for smart traffic lights in here? I vote for smart traffic lights. It's unanimous. It's passed.
You win, Andrew. Well done. This is from Norm.
Who's paying?
Norm writes, this is a question about Ray's second favorite subject. How can a thrown baseball curve, and why does the curve happen after the ball travels straight for 60 feet?
Oh, that's so good.
That's, you know what? Science has been looking into
it
this for a long time.
Tough. There's a course, I think it's at MIT in the graduate program, that talks about the science of the engineering of baseball.
Yeah.
And they spend like more than half of the semester on pitches.
Yeah.
About the knuckleball and about the curveball in particular, more so than the fastball. And then there's like, you know, there's different kinds of sliders too. And people can initiate that slider using different grips too. So it's not always the same spin of the ball that creates a curve. Sometimes it's just it does the curve, and so they call it a curve.
I mean, part of it is illusion as well. So if you are a pitcher and your arm angle is for a fastball that you throw 95 miles an hour is such, and if your curve, you have the same exact arm angle, that hitter is going to think, okay, here comes another fastball, and it's not thrown as hard, and it'll appear to curve. Am I right?
Right. And I imagine a lot of it has to do with the speed of the ball. As the ball's leaving the arm and going towards the pitch, towards the hitter, it's going to wind up slowing down due to friction in the atmosphere. And as a result, the effect of the curve that you placed on the ball in the first place becomes stronger and stronger.
Yeah, the spinning part overwhelms the speed, the lateral speed.
And I'm sure Norm knows this, but there is a brewing controversy in Major League Baseball right now about spin rates and certain Major League pitchers who may or may not be putting some substances on their fingers or on the ball that gives them a better grip and they can increase their spin rate. In these days of analytics, you can say, okay, Garrett Cole throws the ball and that ball spun at 2,900 rotations per minute whatever they call it, revolutions per minute. And, Major League Baseball wants to crack down on this. The flip side of that is the hitters say, hey, they're throwing 100 miles an hour. Anything they can do to grip that ball better makes me feel safer.
Right, not at my head.
You know, it would be really cool now that we have the technology. You could get those balls, and without changing very much, you could put an accelerometer in the ball and actually have an RFID chip in it so that you could not only determine how fast it's moving, but what spin there
was on it. The tumbling spin. I'm sure the Players Union would not like that, I think Mythbusters did that back in the day with some basic accelerometers. But pitchers have been cutting their nails to different lengths. I mean, I don't even want to talk about the illegal stuff that they've put on the balls, you know, by wiping their brow or
whatever. Yeah, well, that's what
whatever,
they're talking about
right?
now, again. But back in the old days, I mean, Gaylord Perry, he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, he admits it freely.
Yeah, he said, I wouldn't have been a professional if I didn't have three or four different sources
he
of
had
the stuff.
He had pitch tar, pine tar stuck in the hair on his arm. He had Vaseline in his pockets.
Barbara, go grab a couple beers out the front. Mm-hmm. We'll talk baseball.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll watch the game, too.
All right, this email is from Steven. Steven says, I know there are other planetary systems and some may be capable of supporting human life. Is Planet X related to this? And that's from Steven. Well, we don't know.
No. Well, Planet X is within our solar system, or is at least within the Oort cloud, which makes it within 200 light years of us.
Yeah.
So it's nowhere near any of these other solar systems.
Okay. And it wouldn't be in the Goldilocks zone because it's so far away from our sun, and it has no perceptible light that would get to it. So it'd be kind of a dreary place. I guess we would just drink beer there.
Fair enough. And speaking of beer, this is from Joe. Joe writes, self-chilling beverage? It was mentioned at the opening, carbonated beverage makes a cloud and cools when the carbonation is released. Is it possible that a beverage could be carbonated such that it would chill itself when opened so that it would not need to be refrigerated beforehand?
Well, you can make the problem is you want it still chilled but not frozen. There are gases you could put into a bubbled beverage, let me just call it that, that when it is released, the pressure differential would be such that it would actually freeze the beer solid. And, you know, then you have a beer sickle. I don't think there's, craft breweries that are selling those yet.
Try and get it out of the bottle.
But, you got to crack the bottle and then lick it and be careful about the glass. So, yeah, you could, but it's a sweet spot.
Yeah, and I am sure that beverage companies have done this, and it's just not cost effective.
Okay. Last email, and then we'll jump back to the phones. This is from Ron in West Stockbridge. Ron says, my friend and I have a disagreement that you must settle. Now you're putting pressure on us, Ron, and I don't like it. Ron writes, one of us believes that the faster you heat up water, the faster it cools down. If you heat a cup of water for tea in the microwave, it'll cool down faster than if you heat the water in a kettle. But one of us thinks it cools down at the same rate. Who is correct?
Welcome back to the studio.
This is the science. In a nutshell, this is the science forum.
So regardless of how you get to the top of the hill, so think of boiling point, 212 Fahrenheit.
Right.
Regardless of how you get there, you know, pedaling a bike to make energy to get the water hotter to get it to boil.
Yeah.
It will always cool. If you take it off and set it in a room of constant temperature with no breeze, it will go down the same way.
Okay. Yeah.
Assuming that it starts off well mixed.
Right.
And assuming
of course.
That
we
it's
said
in a
water,
container
did we
that's
not?
Not insulating.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was water, correct? We said water?
That's what he said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Water.
So we're not talking like a milkshake or anything like that. Just a pure substance, it'll cool down the same way.
No, but in the sense that if it's heated in a way that it's not uniformly heated.
Correct. But we had it boiling at 212, and now, however we got there, it's going to cool down at the same rate.
Okay.
If it was actually boiled and stirred, because, for example, you could have it hotter at the top.
Sure. Like in a microwave. A microwave will do that.
Jim Pickett is here at Standard. Barbara Brabitz. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. And our pal and compatriot, Roger, is going to answer a question for us. Roger, how are you, buddy?
Hey, good afternoon, folks.
Roger!
How's it going?
I heard my name being used in vain.
Yes, indeed. Oh, well, you better have an answer on the surface effect or the
skin effect.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. And you were all over it. You were right on it, Ray. The skin effect is the phenomenon. And I can explain what it is, not necessarily why, but Ed probably can tell me why. The skin effect is the way electrons propagate through conductors. So normally, when you push electrons through a solid conductor, the electrons are evenly distributed across the cross-section of the conductor. As you go up in frequency, the energy, the electrons tend to propagate on the outer edges of the conductor. So the higher in frequency you go, the further out on the conductor they travel. So the effects of the center of the conductor are less and less important to the propagation of the electrons. So as you go up in frequency, the electrical energy propagates more towards the outer surface of the conductor. That's why they call it skin effect. Interesting, in the 50s, Bell Labs developed a very, very low-loss waveguide that was completely hollow in the center. It was just a piece of pipe, and all the energy propagated right down the edges of it. They took advantage of skin effect and a particular propagation mode in the waveguide, and it was an extremely low loss. You know, they could run tens of miles of waveguide with little to no loss as a result of it.
Isn't that what they do now with microwave frequencies and such?
Well, waveguide's a little bit different. It's similar, but it generally you don't have current propagating in the conductor section. It propagates via the mode of transmission. It's more of a transmission mode down a pipe. Skin effect is actually the electrons are propagating through the conductor.
And would it matter if it were AC or DC? That was really, I think, the question.
Yes. You can't get frequencies in DC. It's AC. So the higher in frequency you go, the more the skin effect comes into play. So, and Ray, to answer your question, I don't want to blow you up, but to answer your question, energy propagates down a conductor in if there's current in the conductor, it's called transverse electromagnetic mode. So both the magnetic field and the electric field are transverse to the direction of propagation. Waveguide modes, one of them is propagating down the direction. So there's no current in the waveguide. The one thing that Ed did touch on, I think it was Ed that made the comment, he was talking about audio cables, a little bit different. Obviously, audio frequencies are much lower in frequency than RF energy, so skin effect is less in play. But what they do is they cryogenically treat, and they're typically silver-loaded conductors, they cryogenically treat them to reduce the crystalline structure in the copper and silver in the wire. And theoretically, that makes for a better sound.
Yeah,
and I say theoretically because this is a diminishing returns hobby, and you can spend a lot of money and get very little return. So
there's some snake oil here. Now, you know, Ed loves his stereo. Barbara loves stereo. I love stereo. Roger, you make beautiful tube stereos. Would you ever spend $70,000 on some cables? That's what I want to know.
I think I just have Yo-Yo Ma come over.
If I had $150,000 amplifiers, I might. You know, it's a diminishing returns hobby. It's not to say, but I've been in it far too long to say that I don't hear the difference, but the guy next to me hears the difference. So, you know, if the value is there for him to invest that, there you go. But it's not a skin effect in the audio cable. It's a reduction of the crystalline structure through cryogenic. I actually think they cycle them cryogenically to get rid of the crystalline structure.
Hey, Roger Jaboni, man. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
See you soon, Roger.
Good to hear you guys.
Do we have to pay him for that?
No, I don't know. It's a free. Are we paying you?
Only in beer.
So.
Only in beer, my friend.
Grab whatever you want on the way out. Neil is in Pine Bush. Neil, go ahead.
So I heard you guys talking earlier when I first clicked on about plastics and polypropylene and adding additives to make it more stable for like marine applications for ropes and stuff. But does that make it less recyclable? Like how recyclable are plastics when you put these additives in it? Because it's also said like polypropylene that you get at like a cheap store that's like a one-time use.
Yeah.
Is that less recyclable?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I know there's PLA plastics and ABS plastics and there's all different kinds of plastics,
yeah.
But not all of them you can recycle. Is there like a universal additive that we could add? Wouldn't it be nice if you could recycle all of it?
Yeah, it would be. That's really tough. In fact, stabilizing the plastic would make it more recyclable because it means that it will not have degraded so much during use. One of the problems that why polypropylene is hard to recycle is that it's so easily degraded and so like the stuff that you get containers in the grocery store haven't really been stabilized because they're not expected to have a very long life. So they degrade badly when they're reprocessed. Recycling plastic is just really hard. That's a long topic for another time.
We'll start the show with that next time.
Okay. I was just going to say, if you have polypropylene, some of it that's high grade and some of it's that mid-grade, if you have a post-consumer recycling program and then you have a market to buy that, you have to really do the specs of the material that's been recycled. So when you recycle it, you reprocess it a bit, and then you can check the specs on that. And it ends up being a bit of a mix, and then you can sell it to somebody who wants those specs. So again, it may end up in patio furniture, or it may end up in some kind of post-consumer labeled bag or container.
All right, we have about 1 minute and 20 seconds left or so. Let's go to Walter in Pittsfield. Walter, you're on.
Yes. An observation that I had that baffles me. I bought a helium-filled party balloon, put it in the car. The windows were closed. It was secured to the center console. There was no air movement in the car. Upon acceleration, the party balloon moved forward. Upon braking, it moved backward. This is counterintuitive to me, and I don't fully understand what's going on, if this is in violation of the laws of motion.
I love this.
And inertia.
We have 30 or so seconds.
Yeah, this is a really great thing. What it is because the helium balloon is less dense than the air, when you accelerate, the air will get pushed to the back of the car. Because the balloon is less dense
than
the
air. So when you turn, it'll go the opposite direction as well.
Yes.
Amazing.
It gets pushed forward.
It gets pushed forward. Same thing when you stop, the air moves in the car to the front, pushes the balloon to the back.
And we don't feel it because we're not as less dense as helium.
Yeah. And of course, once the balloon is empty, then it moves the same as the air around it.
Well, what a great way to end the show. A couple of classic questions here for Science Forum. Great to have the panel back live and in person. Barbara Bravitz, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett, thank you all for being here.
Thanks, Ray.
All right. Go get some of that free beer.
I'm already out of here.
She's already gone. Support comes from Watercolors by Edith Schutzbury. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors. Paintings of people and pets from emailed photographs. No contact required. edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And Gold Diggers Jewelers are just off Water Street on Chapel Block Island, offering gemstones, diamonds, and pearls with original Block Island jewelry in sterling and gold. BlockIslandGoldDiggers.com. It's like a Dean Martin special all of a sudden. Here come the Gold Diggers, everybody. Once again, thanks to Barbara Bravitz, Dr. Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thank you to everybody who called in. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our intrepid engineer. Phones were answered. I've forgotten already. Jordan. Jordan Yuxall answered the phones. He left in a hurry, and I'm not surprised. Jackie Orchard is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the show, we'll have some summer cocktails and foods, and we welcome John Fisher and Deanna Fox. That'll be fun. I'll get a designated driver now. Stand by for the Capital Connection.